Welcome everyone to the second Navigating Neurological Conditions webinar. I'm so glad you're here. I'm your host, Jenny Jesse, and I am a mom of a medically complex child and co-founder of the June Jesse Memorial Foundation. I'm on a mission to make lives easier for children with medically complex neurological disorders and their families. Thank you for taking time out of your day to be here. I'm very happy to present Catherine Ara-Ava-Mudin. Catherine is a licensed counselor with years of experience providing therapy to families and adults in a variety of settings with particular expertise in working with parents. She holds a master's degree in professional mental health counseling and is trained in trauma-informed care, parent-child interaction therapy, and dialectical behavior therapy. Today, Catherine and I are going to talk about caregivers' mental health and the importance of taking care of yourself while caring for your child. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Thanks so much again for being here. Okay, so I'm just going to start. We have a lot to talk about today, so I'm going to just jump right in with our first question. Can you tell us a little bit about your role at St. Louis Children's Hospital and what your days typically look like?
Sure, so my title is staff therapist and I work within the perinatal behavioral health service. What that looks like day to day is that my job is to check in on parents and caregivers while they're in the hospital and offer longer term support once they're discharged home. So despite the name perinatal, I work with parents or caregivers who have a child age 0 to 5 with a complex neurological condition, most commonly epilepsy. Pre-pandemic, I would be there on the floor, kind of set up in the epilepsy monitoring unit on the 12th floor of Children's, and I would go room to room for every caregiver with a child ages 0 to 5 in the hospital. Now it looks a little different. To limit contact, I start with phone calls, and I know service can be really spotty in the hospital, so I try the cell phone first, and then I can also speak with parents and caregivers using the room phones, and then if for some reason that doesn't work, I can still go in, but we're really just trying to limit the contact and the exposure of all of our families. And then I just try to normalize any stress, anxiety, or emotional experiences they might be having. It's really hard to be a parent under the best circumstances. And when you're admitted to the hospital, certainly a lot more complicated than that. And so I just try to go through a brief questionnaire, sort of assessing for their stress level and anywhere where I might be helpful. And that's about half of my job. And then the other half looks like providing outpatient counseling or therapy for those caregivers and also attending, you know, the meetings and administrative stuff that goes with working within a medical facility.
Wow, that sounds like you have your hands full and you're doing quite a lot for these families. So thank you. So, I mean, hands full in like a good way, but you're just getting really involved with their lives, you know, just in the hospital, but then once they return home, when a lot of the help is, the support and help is needed. So thank you so much for that. What are some of your initial findings after working with this parent population and how has that changed since the pandemic?
Well, it's a really interesting job as a therapist because I get to see parents in a variety of settings, but also learn about a more holistic range of needs. And so I've learned a lot more about organizations like yours and financial funding, as well as just more sort of wraparound resources like connecting them with social work or local nonprofits that could help them find medical equipment, things like that. About half of all the parents I talk with are reporting some pretty high levels of stress, sometimes depression and sometimes a combination of both. Sometimes that's related to the trauma of going through an ambulance ride or an emergency department admission. Sometimes it's processing a new diagnosis. And sometimes it's just fatigue of years of caregiving. And so depending on where a family is in their medical journey, their experiences can look very different. But I use what are called assessments, and those are just questions of our most common symptoms of anxiety, depression, or trauma-related symptoms. And there's something called a clinical cutoff, which is where someone's scoring high enough that it's likely they would have some sort of mental health diagnosis. I don't go in to diagnose families. I just go in to sort of gauge stress. And so about half of all the families that I speak with that complete that diagnosis score pretty high, which indicates a pretty moderate level of stress.
So once you, this isn't on the question, it just made me think, once you notice that a family has a high level of stress, what do you do from there? Like, where does it go from there?
Sure, yeah, so anytime, I mean, for any parent, really, when I'm going room to room or when I'm talking with them on the phone, I'm trying to assess for coping skills, so what they do to relax or just recharge after a stressful day. And I'm also providing information on what that might look like while they're in the hospital, so utilizing the rooftop gardens if the weather is amenable to that, getting breaks if they're able to have a nurse sit with their child so they can go get some lunch or get some fresh air, something like that. And also talking about how they use their family, friends, and other supports out in the community so that they are really advocating for themselves to be cared for in the same way they advocate for their child to be cared for. If someone is scoring high on one of those assessments I talked about, I do recommend some sort of support, whether that looks like a support group or individual counseling. And that can be with me, or I can help them find someone closer to home if they're traveling in for an appointment like that. We also have psychiatry through Perinatal Behavioral Health Service. So if they'd want to explore medication or have questions about that, I can help them get us set up with an appointment like that.
So, you went through to see some of their coping skills that, you know, you suggest, that going to the rooftop garden or utilizing family and friends and to find ways to take care of themselves. And that's something that I used to hear all the time. A lot of well-meaning people would say, make sure you're taking care of yourself. And I know you're like, it was an issue that everyone knew had to be addressed, but it was a lot easier said than done. And sometimes it would stress me out to think about things, finding ways to do that. And what are some easy ways that you suggest parents can take care of themselves, especially right now when it's a lot harder for everyone to take care of themselves?
Yeah, something has really happened with the term self-care. I think it's been kind of taken over, and it can actually create a lot of stress when I ask people what they do for self-care. So I've tried to ask it in sneakier ways, like how do you relax, or what do you do after a hard day? And especially at the beginning of the pandemic, I noticed how kind of external self-care has become when people would say something like, well, I can't do any of my coping strategies because the gym is closed or the salon is closed, or I can't get my nails done. Or I can't, go and have a glass of wine with my friends at this place where we usually go. And I think coming back to the simple idea that self-care is taking care of yourself. It's acknowledging that you're a human being with some very basic, undeniable needs. And so in the hospital, the quickest, easiest thing that I like to recommend is just a quick body scan, assessing yourself for some basic human comforts. It's usually cold there. You might not have seen sunlight in a few hours or a few days, depending on how long you've been there. Oftentimes there isn't, like a kitchenette in your room or anything like that. So you might not be drinking water as much as you need to or eating the foods that you like. You might be having a lot of cafeteria food, which leaves you feeling uncomfortable or just unsatisfied. So going through those really basic human needs is step one and just kind of the most basic level of self-care. There's an acronym called HALTS that one of my supervisors used. So are you hungry or hot, or in this case, cold? The A is for angry or anxious. The L is for feeling lonely or running late. T is tired or thirsty, and S is stressed or sick. And that just kind of gives you a basic idea of things you can check in on. You know, if you had a maintenance manual, those are things that you could address. And then the higher level of self-care is treating yourself with the loving kindness that you treat other people with. And so that can look like how you talk to yourself or those comfort things. You know, if you enjoy having your nails painted, or making room for yourself to listen to music, take a walk, permission to leave the bedside and walk in Forest Park and get some fresh air and some sunshine.
Wow, those were some really, really great tips that you just... all of which you suggested that we can readily use right now. And I love that idea of just checking in on, kind of sensations and if you're hot or cold, and about sunlight, just like, because sometimes if you don't think to like ask yourself that, you won't notice it. And once you notice it, then you can just make a big leap forward. Like, how can I get sunshine? And it does really feel so good to feel the sun on your face when you've been in the hospital for so long. So. You mentioned some mindfulness exercises, and I wonder if you would mind sharing a specific mindfulness exercise that you suggest to patients. You previously shared one with our June Jesse Memorial Foundation group, and I found that particularly helpful as a way to take a few minutes to tune into myself. And so you can even take me through it if you want, like pretend I'm your client. I don't know if you say patient or client, but pretend that I'm you're running me through it, or however you feel comfortable doing it. But
yeah, so if we were working together, I would start by talking about mindfulness as kind of a lens to view the world rather than a destination. So it's not somewhere where you go for a few minutes. We do use exercises that take 3 to 5 minutes to practice the skill, but the overall goal is just to have you more in tune with each moment and checking in with yourself on a regular basis. And so I know you want an exercise, and I will get there, but first starting with the idea of mindfulness and what it is can be really helpful. There are 3 main ways to practice mindfulness, and that's to observe, to describe, or to participate. And so thinking about what you need in each moment, and then there are how skills for how you practice mindfulness, and that's non-judgmentally. So just kind of sticking to the facts, noticing what is real, what is true, and not necessarily how you're feeling, but just checking in with what the facts are, and one mindfully. So focusing solely on one task at a time or one activity at a time. So those are the what skills and the how skills of mindfulness. So if you're in the hospital and you're feeling pretty stressed, describing your emotions in that situation might not be the most helpful thing for you. Just describing might not be the mindfulness skill you want to try. So thinking about those other ones, you could observe an object in the room and describe it in as many details as you can, or you could try participation, which can look like putting in some earbuds and listening to your favorite song and, you know, like mouthing every word to it, or just really letting yourself kind of be engaged with one thing for 3 minutes that's not overwhelming or stressful for you. What we talked about earlier was kind of a body scan when we were talking about checking in for those basic body sensations. And so that's one that I use pretty frequently, especially early on. It's just having a client sit comfortably and close their eyes if they feel comfortable doing that. Not everyone with a trauma history will feel comfortable closing their eyes, especially with someone they just met. So do whatever is comfortable with for you, either resting your gaze with your eyes open a few inches in front of you or closing them, and just noticing how you're sitting, making sure you're in a comfortable posture with your back straight, and starting with the top of your head and just trying to notice how your mind feels. Is it racing? Is it active? Is it confused? Is it empty? How are you feeling? And trying to just let any thoughts sort of pass by, like cars on the street going past, without judgment or without attachment to any of those thoughts. And slowly working down. A lot of us carry tension in our neck or shoulders. And so noticing without judgment or any self-shaming, are my shoulders up here? Are they relaxed? Is one side more tense than the other? And if there's any adjustment you could make to make yourself more comfortable, a shoulder roll or sitting up straight, anything that you could do to just relax even further. And so just slowly moving down your body in that way, noticing your lungs, your breath. Is it feeling tight today? Is it fast paced, slow paced? Using those non-judgmental, factual, descriptive words. Moving down to your stomach. Do you feel hunger pains? Do you feel full? Do you feel any tension there, sometimes some nausea, some queasiness, or feeling stressed. Moving down your legs, are they crossed? Do you have both feet on the ground? Is there anything you could do in this moment to make yourself, again, a little bit more comfortable? And slowly moving down to your feet and your toes. Can you wiggle them? Can you scrunch them up and relax them? And then at this point, I would ask the client what they noticed.
Well, I just did that with you, and I already immediately just feel just more centered and calmer. And I don't know if that's what some of your clients feel, but just even that quick body scan, I feel just a little bit like, oh, okay. Like I could maybe take a nap, or I could maybe go on with my day a little bit.
And I did it, you know, as I was talking about it, and things like this make me nervous. And so it did help ground me in the middle of this conversation and check in with myself. And I think often we judge ourselves for how we react in a moment, you know, oh, I shouldn't have said that, or oh, I came out too strong. And we don't notice that we're carrying around all of this tension, you know, like how long were my shoulders up by my ears, or how long was I sitting uncomfortably on my third Zoom call of the day or something like that without checking in, you know?
Yeah.
How long has it been since my last glass of water?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it also takes, you know, mindfulness is something that kind of was introduced to me a little bit before I had June, but a lot with June. And I think it does take practice to be able to all of a sudden, like, you know, I think you and I immediately felt something. It does take practice to get that sensation. So if you're even, I remember before when I first did it, like, okay, this is weird, or like, you know, cause like you said, the judgment, but like the more you do it, the easier it is to get kind of that immediate, or not immediate, but that calming sense, I think. I don't know mm-hmm. if you think that too.
Yeah, another really accessible exercise is focusing on your breath. So doing something like square breathing, where you're breathing in for the count of four, holding it for the count of four, breathing out for the count of four, and holding it out for the count of four. Mm-hmm. So all you have to be able to do in that situation is count to four. Anybody can do it and breathe. Anybody can do that and practice that. And another one that I do, just when I have like a couple minutes between sessions or something, is listening to a bell. And you can use YouTube to find, you know, like singing bowls or bell sounds, and then that gives you something to focus on. Because if you tell someone to meditate for 5 minutes, then their thoughts are just racing most of the time. So I really like having the bell, and you just sort of listen to it fade. Mm-hmm. And so it reminds me how attentively I can listen when I'm really trying to listen. You know, I can hear the faintest sound of the bell as it sort of fades into the background. But it also gives me an anchoring point to sort of focus in on.
Oh, I love that. And you said you can find those sounds on YouTube. Just
I can tell you, this is like my son's that he didn't want, but I have this little bowl, and I apologize if this sounds really tinny, but just like that little sound, and then I listen to it fade, and just sort of,
I love that.
Something easy.
I do know also with breathing, so for me, with breathing, sometimes, when you said the breathing count to four, sometimes I'm like, I can't breathe that long. And then like, the weirdest things cause me anxiety, but then sometimes that makes me like, but I have learned that if you kind of lie on your stomach and then try to take a belly breath through your stomach, it's easier for me to access that like deeper breath. I don't know if you've heard that, or like if there's any other breathing, am I missing anything with mindfulness or breathing that you would like to cover?
Speaking to a feeling that I was having, where I think I said something was easy a few times, and it's not easy to start. And when I say easy, I just mean like easy to explain, not as easy to do. Mm-hmm. And also it's going to be different for everyone. So when I said a box breath of four, that's my comfort zone. And someone else's might look like one or two counts or three, you know. So really experimenting and using those mindfulness skills or those body scan skills of what feels good for me. And you were saying it felt good to lay down, and that is not something that is in a textbook that I've read, but it's about your experience. And if it's bringing you comfort, then that's very real and very important.
For some reason, it's easier for me to take a breath, like a deeper breath, if I'm on my stomach.
Unless your lungs expand in the back, you know, it is easier for you to breathe deeply that way. And I do think there is science that backs that up, but it's about what's comfortable for you, rather than me telling you what the best way to do anything is.
Yeah. Okay. Great. In your opinion, since this is something that, you know, this is your job, your career, why is a caregiver's mental health something we should focus on more in especially in pediatric care?
Coming into this job specifically and working with people like Dr. Teo, I think it has been well researched that being a caregiver of a medically complex child comes with a lot of stress. There have been lots and lots of papers that I've come across since starting this job 2 years ago that really support that. And I'm always left with this question of, well, what did they do next? You know, they did the study. There are measures. I can find a worksheet that will assess caregiver stress. And then at the end of the worksheet, that's it. And there aren't like next steps or a phone number you can call or things like that. And a lot of the families I talk with have been told things like, oh, well, this will really be difficult for your relationship. Or a lot of parents of medically complex kids end in divorce. And they carry that weight around, knowing that it's a fact or knowing that they're experiencing more stress than what they see in friends' relationships or what they see in friends who are caregivers or parents. And so having that information, but then not having resources just adds to an already difficult job. So I've always really loved working with parents in all settings, just giving basic parenting skills or support groups, because I as a parent feel like it's a very isolating job. And on your first go around, it's hard to make decisions. As your child gets older, you have to become an expert in a whole new set of skills and relationship styles and deciding what you as a parent want to set for your values. It's really hard. And then on top of this, the families that I'm working with have to become experts in their child's medical care, remembering every dose, every medication schedule, every therapy appointment, all of the equipment, and feeling like they're kind of walking encyclopedias of that information. A lot of parents I speak with feel like they're the only ones that know everything, and they're constantly having to inform other specialists or other therapists or their own spouse sometimes about what happens next or what happens if. And so this is that next step of what you can do. We can recognize, oh, that looks really hard. Oh, that looks really stressful. Oh, you have to do so much. And this is just one like soft place where you can sort of let that down and hopefully gain some skills that make it a little more manageable. I think parents might get tired of hearing like, oh, you're so brave or you're so strong. It's like, you didn't ask for this. It's not like you set out to become this expert in epilepsy or infantile spasms or anything like that. It was forced upon you. And so giving people skills to better manage that stress is really important.
That's a great answer. That was just very beautiful. I don't know if beautiful is the right word, but it was just, yeah.
It's very nice of you.
I just thought it was really great. And it is, I know you're making a difference. I hear from parents, and therapy was so, such a help for me, and it made such a big difference. And I'm just so grateful that you're able to provide this to parents to help them, you know, just be like a life raft for them during this time. So I just am really grateful for you. So this is my last question. How would you recommend parents find a therapist to connect with, and what advice would you give them for making that initial contact to reach out?
Sure. So I know we're based in St. Louis, and if people have any questions or want to speak with me directly, I'm very open to that, and we'll provide my contact information. If a parent is insured, I would look at EAPs or calling the insurance company is a great place to start to find someone that accepts their insurance. A website that's really easy to use is called Psychology Today, and you can search by your zip code and your insurance coverage. And if you have a preferred type of therapy, if you've been in counseling in the past and there's something that really worked for you, you can also search by that specific modality. I made some notes about this, so I just want to review them. I think EAPs and Psychology Today are a great place to start. If a parent is in the NICU and they're seeing this either at Children's or other hospitals across the country, I think it's pretty common for a position like mine to be in the NICU, and usually asking for perinatal behavioral health is a good start. And there are some social workers and trained psychologists that work in children's hospitals. For neurology specifically, I think this is a pretty new field, and I haven't been able to come across a program that's exactly like the one that you've helped create here, Jenny. But just asking about the hospital, they may have a list of therapists that are better, more specifically trained in working with parents of medically complex kids or have experience doing this. And then when you're interviewing, I think remembering that you do not have to go with your first choice. Trying out, a lot of therapists will offer a 20 or 30 minute consultation where you can sort of get a feel for their style and whether or not you feel comfortable with them. Be sure to bring your questions and let them know anything that has been helpful in the past or even not helpful. You know, I really didn't like this sort of exercise, or worksheets are not something that I have time to follow through on. So having that self-awareness can be great. If it's your first time to counseling, I would just focus on the relationship, because I think studies support that the relationship is the most important thing of any sort of therapeutic relationship. And a lot can vary with the different styles or techniques that therapists use. But if a patient doesn't feel comfortable, then you're not going to get very far.
So what is EAP? Is that?
Employee assistance program. So employers will offer 3 to 5 free sessions for their employees. If a new diagnosis comes up, or there's a hospitalization that's, you know, a specific acute amount of acute stress, and you think that 3 to 5 sessions would be helpful, and EAP is a great way to go because it's very cost-effective, often free. Otherwise, going through insurance or looking at Psychology Today.
Okay.
I think the pandemic has in some ways been validating for families. At the beginning, I heard them say, now people get it. You know, they're washing their hands, they're being cautious, they're wearing masks, they're thinking about cold and flu season differently. And they understand like how seriously we've been taking cold and flu season since our child was born, or since they've had this diagnosis. And there's a sort of camaraderie of respecting healthcare workers. And in the beginning, it was maybe validating for some of our families, but longer term, it's been further isolating. Families have lost a lot of their therapies or in-home nursing support. I've gotten a greater sense from caregivers that it's all on me to do this. I have to be everything for everyone, and also somehow work from home and be a teacher and be a physical therapist and do all of these telehealth appointments. And so that's really shifted the dynamic. And I think that we just don't have a lot of good supports in place for our caregivers.
Yeah, I would agree. I heard another mom say, now she's early on in the journey, kind of like you said at the beginning, but she was saying how like the rest of the world is kind of grieving at the same time she is, and that has felt a little bit less isolating in some ways than if everything was going on as normal as possible during all this. But that I've also heard similar things to what you've said at the beginning, but I can see how as time goes on it would just be more isolating too. So
thank you, Catherine, for taking time out of your busy schedule to be part of our Navigating Neurological Conditions webinar. We really appreciate your insight on caregivers' mental health and why this is so important. Thank you for everyone for tuning in. And if you have questions, please visit junejessie.org, or you can visit us on our social channels.